Well, that's par for those preachers' course. If I were a librarian at Fort Hill, South Carolina, I'd get out of town. When Cyril's four bishops reached Constantinople December 7th, Nestorius refused to receive them. John of Antioch, in the letter just mentioned, had passed on to Nestorius copies of the Pope's letter condemning him and also of a letter he, John, had received from Cyril. Long before Cyril's four bishops walked into the sanctuary of the Cathedral at Constantinople that December Sunday to hand over the ultimatum, Nestorius had known all about it. And he had not been idle. It was from Nestorius, it is often said, that the council idea had come. And in the emperor's letter inviting Cyril to the council, there was much to make it evident that the glorification of Alexandria was no part of the program. Cyril's writing separate letters to the emperor, the empress, and the princesses was here declared to be an attempt to divide the imperial family, and the bishop was ordered, not invited, to attend the council under severe penalties. Now, Theodosius, the emperor, disliked Cyril. He thought him proud and overbearing. He had commented to one of his aides that he reminded him very much of Jerry Falwell, a restless agitator and intriguer, and he told him so in a letter that's come down to us. Cyril's writing separate letters to the emperor, the empress, and the princesses was here declared to be an attempt to divide the imperial family. And Cyril was ordered, not invited, to attend the council under severe penalties. On the other hand, the emperor's act had changed the whole situation for Nestorius. In summoning the council, Theodosius, the emperor, had forbidden all and every ecclesiastical change, no matter by whom, until the council had concluded. And when Nestorius now wrote to the Pope of the crimes that were to be brought against Cyril when the council met, he made light of the theological controversy, gave not a hint that he knew of the Pope's judgment, and wrote that Cyril, he hears, is preparing a faith in danger campaign in the hope of distracting the council from his own anxieties. The Pope made no difficulty about the emperor's plan to call a council, nor about the prohibition which, in fact, had called a halt to the summons to Nestorius. And when Cyril wrote to ask whether Nestorius was now to be treated as excommunicated, for the 10 days had long since gone by, the Pope in reply quoted Scripture, that God wills not the death of a sinner, but rather that he be converted and live. And Cyril is exhorted to work for peace with the rest of the bishops. Amazing how the will of the emperor reminds, or rather causes, the Pope to remember Scripture he had conveniently and earlier forgotten. The date of this letter is May 7th, 431. 1 month before the day appointed for the council. 5 months from the day Cyril's deputation tried to deliver the ultimatum to Nestorius. And in those 5 months, the 12 anathemas of Cyril, so to call them, had time to circulate, and in the vast territories where the influence of Antioch was strong, they had raised issues which now quite overshadowed the differences between Cyril and Nestorius, or between Rome and Nestorius even. In the eyes of these Antiochian theologians, the language in which the Bishop of Alexandria had framed his statements revealed him as a pure Apollinarian. And John of Antioch had organized a party to make this clear at the council, and had in the meantime induced two bishops, one of them held to be Cyril's equal as a scholarly writer, Theodoret of Cyrrhus, to come out with public refutation of the Alexandrians' heresies. And this group wrote to the bishops of the West for support, to Milan, and, for example, to Aquileia and to Ravenna. How much of this was known to Pope Celestine when he wrote his letter of May 7th, we do not know, but he surely knew that minds were inflamed. And as he gave Cyril the news that he was not himself able to make the journey to Ephesus, he urged the Egyptian to be moderate, to remember that what the Pope wanted was that Nestorius should be won back. "We must not," said the Pope, "again scripturally be of those swift to shed blood." Amazing how scriptures can be used conveniently. The day after this letter was written, the Pope signed the instruction for the three legates who were to represent him at the council. They were told to act throughout with Cyril and to watch carefully that the authority of the apostolic see was duly respected. And finally, the Pope sent a letter to the council. It is a moving document in which Celestine reminds the bishops of the beloved apostle St. John, whose remains lie in the church at Ephesus, where they're meeting, and reminds them that they are the successors of the 12 apostles, privileged to preserve what their labors had established. See, the council's at Ephesus. It reminds them that John's buried there, and that they represent the apostles. And don't be naughty. The Pope speaks plainly about the Nestorian novelties. They are a treason to the faith. He exhorts the bishops to unanimity and to be courageous in act. Then he presents his legates who will take part in the council and will tell the bishops the things which we decided at Rome were to be done. "Nor do we doubt your assent to all this," the Pope goes on, "when it is seen how all that is done has been ordered for the security of the whole church." To the legates, the Pope entrusted a letter for the emperor, announcing that he would be represented at the council by legates, and praying he would give no encouragement to these novel ideas now causing such trouble, the work of men who would reduce the idea of God to the limits of what a finite intelligence could explore. The Pope leaves it no doubt, and this is in the other letter, that Nestorius is already condemned. If the Pope consents to the case being discussed once more, this is in the hope that the unfortunate man will retract. Of course, when he finds what Nestorina Fay wants every month. The emperor had not convoked every single bishop of the empire to the council, but only a certain number from each of the 59 provinces of his own jurisdiction, the choice being left to the metropolitans. In all, something like 230 or 250 bishops ultimately arrived at Ephesus. Cyril came in a few days before the appointed date. He found Nestorius already established. He had been at Ephesus since Easter with a small group of sympathetic prelates. Cyril had brought with him 50 Egyptian bishops. Sometime after Pentecost, the anti-Nestorius bishop of Jerusalem arrived with 15 supporters. And later came news from the Antiochians, 46 in all, that they had been delayed by accidents. This last group had chosen to travel by the land route, 1,000 miles or more of difficulty, and as it happened, famine-stricken country. The most numerous groups at the council was the bishop, or the most numerous group at the council was the bishops of what we today call Asia Minor, the 19 provinces that then made up the civil dioceses of Asia and Pontus, and the district called Proconsular Asia, which was subject to the emperor's direct rule. It was in this last district that Ephesus itself was situated. In Asia Minor, there were in all something like 300 sees. It was the most Catholicized territory of all the empire. Something like 100 of these bishops came to the council. The bishop of Ephesus, Memnon, acted as their leader, and they were to a man anti-Constantinople. The question of Theotokos, apart from that, they were just against Constantinople and its new power. The repeated attempts of successive bishops of the capital city since 381 to turn the primacy of honor then voted it into an effective hold on the only territory not already dominated by Antioch or Alexandria, and this made the bishops of Ephesus allies of the foe of Constantinople in all these disputes. I mean, don't bother me with doctrine, let's just weaken the Pentecostals so the Baptists can have a place in the televised empire. Meanwhile, the Antiochians did not arrive. Big accident. And the bishops waited for a good 2 weeks after the appointed day, June 7th, in the great city, 200 of them nearly, each with his retinue in the scorching latitude of 38 degrees north. And you get preachers hot. Disputes were frequent, fights and riots with an Nestorian minority in which the town naturally took an interested part. But can't you see him on Nightline, bandaged and black eyes? split screen. All of them bruised. One guy with teeth knocked out. He can't even say Theopocus anymore. But Cyril made no attempt to meet Nestorius. The two prelates avoided each other. Each to the other was a wicked heretic, awaiting his trial and deserved condemnation. And while the bishop of Ephesus forbade the churches of the city to Nestorius, Cyril was free to preach on Nestorius as the enemy of truth, the outcast already condemned by the Pope. Cyril could go on TV. On June 21st, the long wait was broken. Cyril announced that the next day the council would hold its opening session. Immediately, there were protests from the imperial commissioner in the first place, Count Candidian, who was charged with the safety of the council, under orders to prevent any but the bishops from entering the church where the meeting would take place, and with keeping order in the council itself. Can you see the news media watching this? Fistfights on the suburbs. To see that every bishop who wished to speak was allowed to speak and to reply to attacks made on him. Also to see that no bishop left Ephesus until the council had ended its business. Lock them in, man. Let them fight it out. Candidian demanded a delay until the Antiochians arrived. So did no fewer than 68 bishops in a written protestation. And Nestorius, with his party, made their protest too, saying the council was no council until all the bishops were assembled. And there were 46 from Antioch that had been delayed because of the accident. They had borrowed a bus from Jimmy Swagger. It broke down. They'd unloaded the piano and all the other stuff. Still wouldn't go. Cyril stood to his announcement, and on June 22nd, the council opened without the Antiochians, still stuck in the mud down there in their bus. A memorable first session in which much was enacted and in which still more lay mischievously latent. The question had been raised, by what authority Cyril thus opened the council, acting as though he was its acknowledged president. I mean, Nestorina Fay had said, don't sign it. That the mass of the bishops at the time accepted the fait accompli without any sign of protest, even the 68 signatories, is certain. They will be asking how Jerry Falwell took charge, but the fait accompli has been accepted. You're not interested in this. The council then settled down to business. And what business it was. You want me to finish?
Yes, sir.
Go on telephone. It's your turn to talk to me and urge me a bit. I mean, I can only stand church fights so long. They've been going on 1,900 years.